Blog Talk Radio.
Going round and round and round and round. Life is a three-ring circus. And I tell you what, all you young ladies out there, you know, in fact, that is true. But it's a circus. You eat popcorn, you have cotton candy, and you laugh with the clowns because what goes around comes around. This is The Last Word. I'm Michael Lawson. This is Friday, April the 5th. And I want you to remember one thing. Remembrance of things past is not necessarily the remembrance of things as they were. Now, that can mean many things to people. But if you know how things were in the past, and they were good, they will always be good in your mind. Just remember that. Marcel Proust, that was his quote. But we got a bang-up show today, ladies and gentlemen. And those of you who want to call in, 646-716-5242, if I can get to you, because we're going to have, I think Thomas is not here. I'm operating solo. He's in Mississippi, the coast of Mississippi, visiting his wife's family on the beach. When you dig a sandcastle, you not only have a sandcastle, but you have an oil-rich sandcastle, because the oil is still coming up out of the beach, out of the sand. Go ahead, Shell Oil and BP. You're really doing a great job. We're going to also have Mark Potok, the Southern Poverty Law Center editor-in-chief for the Intelligence Report. Going to be talking about these morons running around with all these guns. We're going to talk about the NRA. We're also going to have Brenda Spencer, a.k.a. Legacy, singer, director, bon vivant. She put on a major event down in Troy, New York, which I happened to be the MC for last week, which was great. We're also going to have Mr. Richard Pratt, one of the original founding members of Blue Magic. We just heard a little bit of Blue Magic. We're going to hear some more about Blue Magic. And I think we're going to hear from Dr. Grace Lynn Galloway, who is the chair of the Democratic Party in Cabarrus County, if she can fit into her busy schedule, run around with her great partner in crime, Joe Galloway. We had on the show last week, and we're going to have back again to tell us about the Afghan and Iraqi wars. But just before we get to all that, let's do a news roundup for the week. It seems that the Regressive Party seems to be up with their panties in a tight fit over the UN adopting a global arms treaty. They adopted a global arms treaty, and guess what? The United States did not sign on. You know why? Stupid. That's why. And you can't help stupid. So we joined three other people in the world. Syria and Iran. Can you believe that? Syria, United States, and Iran. What a gruesome threesome. We're also going to be, they'll be talking about this possible link with the Texas shootings and Tom Clement. We're going to be going further in with that with Mark Potok, because there seems to have been an arrest made for the shooting of the prison superintendent in Colorado. And they're still looking for the people, the perpetrators of the crime that shot the district attorney and his wife and the assistant district attorney about 2 months ago. So we're going to be talking about that. We're going to talk about the innate National Rifle Association. And listen, I want to tell you something right now. You need to boycott Blue Bloods. I love that show, and I have about 10 of them on my DVR right now that I'm not going to watch until Tom Selleck gets off his ass and says that he is not going along with that moron who is now representing the NRA. Tom Selleck is a member of the National Rifle Association Board of Directors for over 20 years. He needs to now come and speak up. He needs to now speak up. You had a free ride, Tom. Now it's time to get on the stick. You've been a board member, and you've cowered behind that board. Well, speak up. You're supposed to be the commissioner in the TV series Bluebird of New York City. Well, you know what? You'd be fired if Bloomberg, you were working for Bloomberg. So you need to start doing something. And we need to talk about the daggone Tennessee and Mississippi lawmakers who have now, let's talk about Tennessee first. Tennessee now has cut welfare to families whose kids do not do well in school. If you're on welfare and your child fails in school, they are going to cut your welfare check. Can you believe that? This is just, it's got completely out of hand. These dumb superintendents, not superintendents, law of the House members and Senate members in these red states have now crossed the line. But you see what, ladies and gentlemen? It's your fault because you did not get out and vote in 2010. And they redistricted all these southern states. That's why they have control. And it's going to be that way for the next 10 years unless you get out in the streets. If you go block traffic, go to the courthouses, go to the governor's house. That's where you need to camp out, at the governor's house of these regressive party red states, because they're trying every single thing in the book. And Ed Schultz, I love Ed Schultz on MSNBC. I love Ed. But, Ed, I'm sorry. I listened to your show today, and you have gone over. You're on the deep end now. I mean, you're out. You might as well be a radical. This, we have a president of the United States that wants to get something done. And if he's going to cough up or try to cut back a little bit on CPI, that's the cost index where we rank how much Social Security you get from how the market goes, you know, the cost of living. We need to do something. And here's the problem. He's offering that up as part of the bargain, but you know Republicans are not going to take it. They have not taken one single thing that he has offered up since he has become president. Every single time he offers something up as a bargain, they say, oh, no. But you know what? 70% of the stuff he's offered up to them was their idea. He has only taken their ideas and given it back to them and said, yes, I'll take this. But because he's given it, they reject it. He could give, I'm going to give every one of you guys $1 million. They would refuse it because there's a black man in the White House. That's all it is. There's a black man now in their so-called White House. So, you know, it doesn't matter. And I don't know, Ed just doesn't seem to understand this. He says, no, we have to get on the president. He has to stop this. He shouldn't be offering them anything. You got to, you're there. When you come to Washington, it's compromise. You might not like it, but you have to give. You have to give. Now, he has been given and given and given, and they have not taken anything. Every single time, he gives them back their own plan for helping the government. They refuse it because it's now coming from him. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out, Ed. So you're absolutely right. I completely disagree with you. Completely. He knows that they are not going to take this. He knows they're not going to take this because, you see, the regressive party only deals with mental midgets and morons, the people that listen to Fox Radio. They don't read the newspapers. They get all their information from Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and Bill O'Reilly. And those morons, they're early, that sit around those the three stooges that sit around in the morning on Fox News. So therefore, they're not understanding and they're not getting any information that they should be getting. So just remember, don't get yourself in a tizzy because the president offers them something. They're not going to take it. It don't matter what he offers them. They will not take it. They will not take it. What can I say? What can I say? Let me go now and talk about some of this stuff that's going on in these shootings in Texas and all around the country, which I think is really getting out of hand now. This is really getting out of hand. I mean, I just do not know how much more the NRA can start saying we need to arm our kids. We need to keep, well, that's what the next thing is. They're going to say arm our kids. You know, this reminds me of the, you know, everybody ever listen, remember Archie Bunker? Well, you know, Archie Bunker offered a major, major problem solution for guns. Let me play this for you.
Last Saturday.
Good evening, everybody. This is Archie Bunker of 704 Hauser Street, veteran of the big war, speaking on behalf of Guns for Everybody. Now, question. What was the first thing that the communists done when they took over Russia? Answer, gun control. And there's a lot of people in this country who want to do the same thing to us here in a kind of conspiracy, see. You take your big international bankers, they want to, masticate the people of this here nation like puppets on a wing. And then when they get that done, they turn us over to the communists.
I'm glad they put you on the stool. You look tall and sitting down.
Now, I want to talk about another thing that's on everybody's mind today, and that's your stick-ups and your skyjackets, which, if that was up to me, I could end the skyjackets tomorrow.
You could?
All you got to do is arm all your passengers. He ain't got no more superiority there. And he ain't going to dare to pull out no rod. And then your airlines, then they wouldn't have to chase the passengers on the ground no more. They just pass out the pistols at the beginning of the trip, and they pick them up again at the end. Case closed.
That's incredible, huh? What do you mean?
So, is that the answer? Every single elementary kid who's in school, I guess we don't have to go down to preschool yet, but, you know, we might have to be maybe a pre-K, first grade, kindergarten, maybe kindergarten. Give every kid a gun before as he enters the classroom so he can take it along, put it in his backpack, and go classroom to classroom. Hey, we can give him 40 hours of training. Because that's all they're saying that they need. Give me a break. Well, that really wasn't the way I wanted to introduce our guest that's on the line right now. But I am with deep honor, I now want to introduce a spokesperson who is the Director of Publications and Information for the Southern Poverty Law Center, Mark Potok. Let's see, I get him on there. Mark, how are you?
Oh, very well. A pleasure to be here.
I wanted to play that that old. I don't know if you were able to hear the Archie Bunker scenario. Now that's from an old show. But is the NRA? Do they have this same mentality?
Well, I mean, yeah, basically. I mean, you know, I mean, they're making the same argument, give everybody a gun for everything, you know, and then presumably the quote-unquote good guys will outnumber the bad guys, and, you know, when the bullets stop flying, I guess, right will have won. But it's more than that. I mean, the NRA has promoted for many years now essentially a conspiracy theory about Barack Obama. You know, the NRA, in the fall of 2008, when Obama, of course, was a candidate the first time around, ran a campaign with a couple of its firearms manufacturing friends called Prepare for the Storm. You know, it sounded awfully close to me like look out for the black dude who's going to be in the White House and come take your guns. But in any case, it was, you know, essentially a conspiracy theory. And Wayne LaPierre, of course, the executive vice president of the NRA, has been saying ever since then that Obama is a big liar. You know, that in fact, you know, while he acted during the first term like he was loosening gun control, as he did in a couple of instances, and acting like he had no intention of attacking the Second Amendment and so on, that the president had a secret plan in his second term to really go after guns.
Oh, and of course, it was absolute hogwash.
As it happened, by a strange twist of fate, the Newtown massacre kind of pushed gun control into Obama's lap. He was virtually forced to take it up. But in any case, you know, the NRA is very heavily into this conspiracy theorizing. You know, there's a massive plan to take all of our guns. This is just the beginning of a gun registry and so on. And ultimately, none of us will be armed.
Well, you know, Ed, what you say, the public support for stricter gun sales is like 60%, and the people who don't support it is only 5%, and the people who want to have it to stay the same is 33%, and then of course you got 2% that are unsure, but they also have a ban on assault weapons. The people, they want to ban assault weapons at 59%. And only 37% want to oppose it. So, not forgetting the universal background check was up to 87%. With all these numbers, facing these this regressive party and the NRA, and it's not the NRA members, it's the NRA board. And before you got on, I was talking about Tom Selleck, who's been a member of the NRA for over 20 years and has not spoken one single thing out about what is happening about guns. And he plays the commissioner of police in New York City on his TV show. I mean, that's just outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
It is right. So one thing I want to for you to explain to us, because you have spoke about this abroad. You've spoken in front of the Senate and UN on UN United Nations on High Commission for Human Rights. What is the difference between a patriot group and a hate group, or are they same?
Sure. I mean, a hate group is what one generally thinks of, a Klan group, a neo-Nazi group. I mean, the way we define it on our website is we say, you know, all hate groups have beliefs or practices that attack or malign an entire class of people, typically for their immutable characteristics. So, you know, some of the groups we list as hate groups are, you know, virulent anti-black groups, anti-white groups, anti-Muslim groups, anti-immigrant or anti-Latino groups, and so on. So that's fairly, I think, self-explanatory. The patriot groups are the groups that we used to all describe of as back in the 1990s as militia groups. They are groups generally with quite a fondness for paramilitary training. They're very much into guns, to relate back to our earlier conversation about gun control. But, you know, their enemy is not a particular minority of people, black people, gay people, the Jews, that kind of thing. It is instead the government. And basically what people in patriot groups believe is some form of the following conspiracy theory. They think that the government has a secret plan to impose martial law on the United States, very likely with the aid of foreign troops, probably UN blue helmets. Next will come the seizure of all weapons from American private citizens by the government. Anyone who resists, or so the theory goes, will be thrown into concentration camps that either have been built already or are right now being constructed by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which didn't do too well with Katrina, apparently is very good at running concentration camps. And ultimately, the United States, will be forced into some kind of socialistic one-world government, the so-called New World Order. So that's what it boils down to. It's a whole set of conspiracy theories that are focused on the federal government being an evil actor, a conspirator.
But the Tea Party, and now tell me if I'm wrong about this, when it was formed with the basic opinion that the government was doing them wrong and that they were needed to change the government. And but it seems like that is where they fall in line with a patriot group, because at many of their rallies, guys are walking around with guns strapped to their legs.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are similarities. To me, they're not the same, but you know, the patriot or the Tea Parties are essentially right wing populist groups, and you know, a lot of their anger was over economic issues. And you're right, you know, they see themselves as constitutionalists, sort of defending the real meaning of the Constitution and all that kind of thing. There's also no question that there were real streaks of racism in the Tea Parties. A couple of the Tea Party formations are openly racist. But, you know, they are not the same as the patriot groups in the sense that they're not built around this central conspiracy theory. You know, it's not just that you think government is too big, or you think it ought to be drowned in a bathtub, or you think that we ought to have unlimited Second Amendment rights and the government is the enemy of that. It's that, you know, the government is seen by the patriot groups as explicitly involved in this very elaborate conspiracy, you know, to destroy American liberties. So it's a bit beyond the Tea Parties. Now, you know, that said, we've seen a lot of cross-pollination between these various kind of formations on the far right. So we see patriot groups mixing with the Tea Party formations. We see, for instance, there's a guy named Richard Mack, former Arizona sheriff, who actually led or was one of the plaintiffs suing the government over the Brady Bill back in the 1990s. Well, you know, Richard Mack became in the 90s a big hero to the first patriot movement, and he has once again become a kind of iconic figure in the second wave of the patriot movement that we're seeing now. And Richard Mack has given close to 100 speeches to Tea Party groups. I mean, he's very much a part of the patriot movement. So that is the kind of thing we see a lot of on the right generally, people adopting one another's conspiracy theories, you know, ideology kind of seeping from one group into the other.
Mm-hmm. Has Mack fallen under your observation as someone to watch as far as
I mean, we've written quite a bit about Richard Mack, and you know, Richard Mack is on the board of a group called the Oath Keepers, which is a group we list as a patriot group. The Oath Keepers says that it is made up entirely of current and former members of law enforcement in this country and of the military. And, you know, and they describe themselves as, you know, we're just good patriots, and they call themselves the Oath Keepers because they ask that those people re-pledge their oath. And I'm talking about their oath to defend the Constitution, you know, against all enemies, foreign and domestic, which is, you know, what people take when they go into the military or join law enforcement. Well, so far so good. I mean, that's all perfectly benign, certainly as far as we're concerned. But then you look into the Oath Keepers a little further, and you see that the whole group is built around something called the 10 Orders We Will Not Obey. Well, you know, what are those orders? I mean, I don't have them in front of me. I'm paraphrasing, but they are, you know, we will not aid in the imposition of martial law in the United States. We will not help send Americans to concentration camps. We will not, you know, help create ghettos in the city. So, in other words, when you look at it, you understand pretty quickly it's a straight-up patriot group. It's completely involved in a set of conspiracy theories about what the government's doing. And so I think it's a particularly worrying group in the sense that these aren't just, you know, somewhat oddball citizens, you know, live out there in the outback someplace. These are men and women who are armed by the rest of us, by society, to defend us against crime and against real enemies out there. And it seems to me very destructive, or at least dangerous, to have these people running around believing, you know, as they do these jobs, that the government is in a conspiracy to destroy us.
Well, but when you have senators and congressmen like Rand Paul and Louis Gohmert saying the things they're saying about the government, doesn't it give more emphasis to these groups to say, hey, look,
yes,
our elected officials are with us?
No, I totally agree. And, you know, I mean, I was a reporter during the first wave of the militia movement, which was basically 94 to the end of the 90s. And there was some mainstream sort of political support for the militia movement. I remember, you know, there's a congresswoman from Idaho, a woman named Helen Chenoweth, who was pretty widely known in the press as the poster girl of the militia movement. There were a certain number of state legislators in places like Texas and Colorado and Oklahoma and a few sheriffs who were really, you know, kind of waving the flag of the militia movement. But that was where it ended, pretty much. Today, we see these kinds of absolutely insane things being said in the public square, conspiracy theories with zero basis in reality, by, as you say, people who are congressmen, people who have national shows on cable television or even the networks. You know, so it's very much in the mainstream. And I'll give you one example, which to me is shocking. There's a United Nations plan called Agenda 21, which is basically a sustainability plan, a kind of green plan, that was signed by the first President Bush in 1992, along with the leaders of 177 other nations. And, you know, it's essentially a feel-good plan about, you know, we ought to not destroy our planet, that kind of thing. But the real point about Agenda 21 is that it has no legal weight whatsoever. It's not a treaty. There are no legal obligations to anyone at all. In other words, Agenda 21 cannot force any American to do anything. And the same is true of all the other signatories.
Right.
And yet, courtesy of the John Birch Society, the old crazy anti-communist group that accused President Eisenhower of being a communist agent and said fluoridation of water was a, you know, plot to destroy our minds, children.
They're still talking about that on the air.
Yeah, right. Well, so the John Birch Society has been pushing this theory that Agenda 21 is a plot against the United States, a plot to destroy private property and capitalism in this country. Well, again, in a way, who cares what the John Birch Society thinks? Well, in January of 2012, a little over a year ago, the Republican National Committee adopted as a platform plank opposition to Agenda 21, which it described as a, quote, insidious scheme, unquote, to strip away Americans' property rights and to impose, quote, socialism/Marxism, unquote, on our country. I think that's just astounding. And, you know, now we're seeing states like Oklahoma, my own state here in Alabama, you know, trying to pass laws against Agenda 21. It's very much like the anti-Sharia movement, the idea that, you know, Muslims have a secret plan to impose Islamic religious law in this country. It's just bogus, utterly bogus.
Well, see, the thing that I have in mind is, has the election of a black president changed the thinking of these hate groups and these patriot groups? Or has it just given them an excuse to voice their conspiracy theories and their other deeds?
Well, I think what the election of a black president has done has made a lot of these groups more and more desperate, actually, because it's a little like what's going on with same-sex marriage. They're losing the battle. These groups can, you know, bitch and moan and pound, you know, stomp their feet and bang their fists on the podium, but nothing they will do will prevent the loss of a white majority in this country in the next 20 or 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's happening. And, you know, they could close the borders tomorrow, never let another immigrant into this country, and it would still happen simply as a matter of differential fertility rates, essentially, between Latinos and whites. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and the groups are not entirely stupid. So they realize that. So when I say they're becoming more and more desperate, the solution, you know, they become more and more revolutionary. The only way we can really make change happen in this country is, you know, we've got to blow up federal buildings. We've got to murder cops, that kind of thing.
Right.
And it also affects the actual shape of the ideology. I mean, the radical right in the United States used to be white supremacists. They wanted to bring back a world in which white people ruled over other people. Well, now, you know, that's essentially undoable in the United States at this point.
Yeah.
And that's why virtually the whole extreme right, these hate groups, call themselves white separatists, because they realize their only hope is to carve the United States up into little mini ethnic territories. You know, there's
right.
been this been going on for 15, 20 years where you see some of the Aryan, quote-unquote, groups saying we should all move to the Pacific Northwest and make that the great white homeland and so on.
Well, and that's a lot of reasons why some of these states want to see if they can separate from the United States. Well, a la Texas, you know, says, oh, yeah, we can leave anytime you want. We don't have to be part of the United States. Well, you know, if you went to school, even to the fifth grade, you know that's impossible. I mean, so it really, but, you know, what I wanted, the Peace Patriot groups, I believe over like 1,300 and I reached an all-time high last year.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, by our count. Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that has the states now, Connecticut is one of them, New York State, Maryland yesterday signed a gun law, that as these gun laws are starting to be passed in these individual states, and the Congress delays passing any laws at all, is that sending a message to these groups that it's okay what you're doing?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's sending a message to them. I think that, you know, the message it's sending to all the rest of us is the incredible power of the gun lobby in this country. You know, and I think the NRA fundamentally doesn't represent hunters or anything like that.
No.
It represents gun manufacturers and gun salesmen.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, that's what it tells us. I mean, you know, of course, we've all seen those figures. You know, enormous majorities of Americans support various forms of gun control, especially, of course, universal background checks.
Right.
You know, and yet the NRA obviously doesn't give a damn. And at the same time, obviously, has a whole lot of congressmen and senators in their pocket, or if not precisely under their pocket, certainly willing to vote the way they want them to vote, despite the wishes of the American people. So, you know, so it has fallen to the states, and good for places like Connecticut that actually have the get up and go to act. And, you know, apparently the state legislatures aren't so much in the pockets of the NRA, or certainly not in the case of non-Western states. So, you know, maybe this is one of those things. It's going to play out like medical marijuana has played out, right, where it
right.
starts at the
right.
state level and spreads from state to state, and eventually you get recreational marijuana,
right.
you know, referenda and statutes and so on. And it seems to me obvious that at some point the federal government's going to have to give. And like I say, maybe that's how it's going to play out with gun control.
Well, the NRA, what sort of message do you think the NRA is sending to these hate groups with their message on guns?
Well, I mean, I don't think the NRA really needs to send any message to these groups. These groups are almost universally into weaponry, and oftentimes very heavy weaponry, and that's especially true of the Patriot groups, which really are built around guns and Second Amendment rights and so on. You know, I mean, we mentioned the count of our groups, and we've mentioned this in our conversation, but we've seen explosive growth on the part of the Patriot groups. There were a mere 149 of these Patriot groups in 2008. By last year, 2012, 4 years later, as you mentioned, there are 1,360 of the groups.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been this huge expansion of the groups. And now, even after that latest count, we finished that count around the middle of December, very end of December, right around the Newtown massacre, which is actually on December 14th. Well, you know, in January and February, as you know, a real discussion, the first serious discussion about gun control took place in this country, the first discussion since the early 90s when the Clinton bans passed. And that has really poured fuel on the fire that's not even reflected in the numbers we've been talking about. So what I'm trying to argue is that this whole debate about gun control has very much stoked up these groups even further than they were already, and as a result, I really expect them to continue this very rapid growth into the next year or so.
Well, you know, I was trying to do some research on this, and then what I found out is that it seems that the NRA keeps saying, oh, yeah, we've had a 2,000% increase in people want to buy guns and ammunition. But isn't it the same people who already have 25 guns, they bought another 25 guns? It's not new people going out.
Well, I think that's probably right, and I say that because you probably saw the same poll I did, but in the last month or so there was a poll that showed, it was published in the New York Times, that showed far fewer households than I think most people expected actually have guns. If I recall, it was somewhere around a little more than half. You know, so it's not, what's not true is, you know, 90% of American households don't have guns.
Right.
So, and yet at the same time, we know absolutely that there were enormous surges in purchases of guns and ammunition, both right around the time of Obama's first election and then his reelection. And I can testify, I'm here in Alabama, for instance, near my house, there's a huge Bass Pro outlet that, you know, had a very large counter full of guns. And that counter's been stripped clean, stripped bare in the last couple of months. So, yes, I think the evidence suggests exactly what you're saying, that these are people who are already gun owners in a big way, who are simply buying more guns and more ammunition. And those sales are being fed by fear that is being stoked by the NRA, which keeps suggesting that, you know, the end game is Obama's going to take all your weapons. So buy right now before it's too late. I mean, that's always their message.
Well, I know you've been on every single show there is on TV in the last 2 weeks, and I know you got to run because I know you got to go someplace else. But I'm so grateful to have a chance to talk to you in a short time, and I just want you to come back. You always give us a lot of information that people. You know, if you listen to Fox, you never know any of this was happening. So, but I want to just thank you for being available to us and to the listening audience, and I'd love you to come back.
Oh, well, a real pleasure, and I'd be really happy to come back anytime. So, really, I'm happy you had me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Mark Potok, who is from the Southern Poverty Law Center. And he is editor-in-chief of the Intelligence Report, which is their journal that they put out. And Mark has been with us a couple of times before, and we are looking forward to have him back again. So, ladies and gentlemen, don't worry about everybody running and buying guns. And here's the thing. Joe Blow next door has 25 guns, and he just bought 25 more. Gee, how many hands does Joe have? Oh, you know what? He must have saw one of those Arnold Schwarzenegger movies where he was firing an M16 in one hand and a 50 caliber in the other hand. But that's only two guns. How's he going to fire 50? Let's think about that, because I know there must be a way for him to fire 50 guns at a time. It has to be, because who in their right mind would buy 50 guns if there's only four people in the house or one person in the house? I mean, to me, that makes no common sense whatsoever. You know, this seems like it's a problem for our captain of our ship.
I know exactly what he'll tell you. Lies. He was no different from any other officer in the wardroom. They were all disloyal. I tried to run the ship properly with a book, but they fought me at every turn.
Yes. That's what happens. They fought me at every turn. We would try. We're only the NRA. We know what's good for you. You don't know what's good for yourself. That's why the NRA is here. Because we know. Oh, and by the way, how many of them have ever been in the military? Wayne LaPierre, the scared little punk, has never been in the military. Never. Just listen to Chuck Hagel when he was talking to that punk, Graham. Oh, yes, Graham was in the military, but as a lawyer, he never set foot out of the continental United States. Listen to what Chuck Hagel told him.
I saw it from the bottom. I saw what happens. I saw the consequences and the suffering and the horror of war. So I did question a surge. It wasn't an aberration to me ever. I always ask the question, is this going to be worth the sacrifice? Because there will be sacrifice. In the surge case in Iraq, we lost almost 1,200 dead Americans during that surge. And thousands of wounded. Now, was it required? Was it necessary? Senator McCain has his own opinion on that, shared by others. I'm not sure. I'm not that certain that it was required.
Hey, this is a man who was shot 3 times. This is a man who got a Silver Star and a Purple Heart. This is a man who's seen war up close. Not like these so-called 80% of these hate groups and patriot groups who never, ever, ever step foot out of the United States to have somebody fire back at them. Every one of them are good at shooting targets and deer that can only run. That's what they need to go out hunting polar bear with a bow and arrow. See how tough they are. You know, you watch all these reality shows, SWAT people, and they're standing there with their big guns and showing their muscles. Yeah, they're hunting alligators. Alligators can't shoot back. These alligators ain't coming into the city. They're going out into the alligator's territory, into the swamp, to kill an alligator. Now, can you give me a break? Did that show any sort of macho? It doesn't. It doesn't show any macho at all. And I just want to make sure that everybody understands that sometimes they just can't handle the truth.
Your orders are always followed. And why would Santiago be in danger? Why would it be necessary to transfer him off the base?
Santiago was a substandard Marine. He was being transferred.
Not what you said. You said he was being transferred because he was in grave danger.
That's correct.
You said he was in danger. I said grave danger. You said, is there
any other... I recall what I said.
I can have the court reporter read back to you.
I know what I said. I don't have to have it read back to me like I'm...
Why did you orders? Colonel?
Sometimes men take matters into their own hands.
No, sir. You made it clear just a moment ago that your men never take matters in their own hands. Your men follow orders or people die. So Santiago shouldn't have been in any danger at all, should he have, Colonel?
Snotty little bastard.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask for a recess.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
The court will wait for an answer.
If Lieutenant Kendrick gave an order that Santiago wasn't to be touched, then why did he have to be transferred? Colonel, Lieutenant Kendrick ordered the code red, didn't he? Because that's what you told Lieutenant Kendrick to do.
Object! Will you look bad? You cut these guys loose!
Your Honor, you have more reason to try to go to transfer.
Your Honor, you doctored the logbook.
Answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want
truth. Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties. You want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
Did you order the code red?
I did the job.
Did you order the code red?
You're goddamn right I did!
Please, the court. I suggest the members be dismissed so that we can move to an immediate Article 39A session. The witness has rights.
Captain Ross.
Jack?
The members of the court will retire to an ante room until further instructed.
All rise!
What the hell is this? Colonel, what's going on? I did my job. I do it again. I'm going to get on a plane and go on back to my base.
You're not going anywhere, Colonel. MPs, guard the Colonel.
Yes, sir.
MPs, guard the Colonel. But you know what? He was a colonel in the United States Marine Corps. He wasn't a colonel in some bogus patriot group that don't know where their next meal is coming from. Some bogus patriot group that hunts deer, Bambi, and Bugs Bunny in the bush and want to pretend that they are protecting this country. The Constitution does not say they have the right to have a gun. It does not say it. It says under a strict militia. You can't just say I'm a militia. You can't just say I'm going to form my own militia. It's a state-sponsored militia. The state has to control it. But we don't call it militia. We call it the National Guard. So if you want to do this, you need to do what Colonel Nathan Jessup said. Swear to an oath, put on a uniform, grab the gun, and stand post. Otherwise, get the hell out of my face. These guys are all pretend. They probably have little or no balls. They could not even get anything up if they wanted. They're using their gun for it. That's all. They're punks. They never stood post to protect this country. Not one time did they ever stand to protect this country. And yet, they want to convince you, you people out there who don't know any better, you people out there who just don't know. Don't be one of those people that doesn't know. Because the people that don't know are the ones that got us into the position we are right now by not voting. You didn't vote, therefore, it didn't count. It didn't count. And that's what we need to see. We need to see people who want to stand up. We need to see people who are going to stand up and be counted. People who want to be a part of the solution and not part of the problem. Like, I can't even get into like now, but it's just the same as these so-called patriots. It's just unbelievable. So I just want to make sure that everybody out there that knows you will help the country when you get and join the military. Not by pretending to be a so-called militia or trying to pretend you're in the army by running through the woods. That's not, you're not protecting anybody. That's pretend. Because I'm telling you, you can have all the daggone guns you want sitting in your house. And if the daggone federal government is going to send SEAL Team 6 in after you, your ass is grass. So forget it. It's as simple as that. Do you actually think you with 50 guns in your house and a few of your phony friends are going to prevent SEAL Team 6 from coming in after you? I don't think so. It ain't going to happen. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, you got as much firepower as SEAL Team 6. Well, you don't have any stealth helicopters. And you don't have any YF-22s. You don't have any of that. You don't have any Abrams tanks. So you can pretend all you want. But these conspiracy theories are so outrageous and so outlandish. There's a show that comes on Coast to Coast that I love. Art Bell was the host of that, and I just loved Art Bell. And I like George Norrie too. But you know what, George? You have so many of these morons coming on here. The show is becoming comical. It becomes, they have so many outrageous theories, and they pretend like there's millions of people that think along the same way as they do. There aren't millions of people. It's not millions of people that think that same way. It is not millions of people. Even if it was 5 million out of 300 million, come on. And very seldom, very, very, very seldom, George, do you have somebody come on your show that takes issue with what those morons have said, like this Alex Jones, another punk who's never been in the military. But yet he'll talk about it left and right. He'll talk about invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. Oh, yeah, we need to do that. He's a punk. And yelling at Piers Morgan didn't prove that he was nothing else. Oh, it didn't. It proved he was a punk. So, you know, some of these people, It just defies the law of logic. It defies the law of logic. Let me just play this for you.
Happened last night. The news media, poll, Reuters poll showed us that basically nothing happened. That today, in a poll taken today, that President Obama has gone up 1 point from 47 to 48. Mitt Romney's gone up 2 from 41 to 43. That's movement within the margin of error. It means absolutely nothing. The Denver Post headline today uses a sports analogy, uses a boxing analogy, round one. John Ingold, who wrote the Denver Post front page story, switches to another sport, if we can call bullfighting a sport, in the first paragraph of his article. It's really, really perfect. Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney rhetorically charged at President Barack Obama in their first presidential debate at the University of Denver on Wednesday. In a clash that was notable for Romney's aggressiveness and Obama's reluctance to engage in a direct fight. Here's the great part. Like a bull to a matador, Romney time and again turned toward Obama to deliver attacks on the president's job performance, portraying him as clueless to his political, to his policy's impacts, and hopeless in trying to turn the economy around. Like a bull to a matador, Romney time and again turned toward Obama to deliver attacks. Like a bull to a matador. And what does a matador do to the bull in the end?
Mr. Fortenberry, what
Hello,
does
sir.
The matador do to the bull in the end?
Well, there's that sword and a little bit of putting out of the misery.
Oh, speaking of us, I'm looking at this fool, Wayne LaPierre, big full-face front on my TV right now. Oh, man, just gets me sick. Another punk, never went in the military. But yet he wants to tell you, give people 40 hours of training on them guns. Just like I was talking to Mark Potok about that. My idea is, why don't we give the kids in kindergarten 40 hours of training? They can't hold the big guns, but they can hold a 38. Snub-nose.
Right.
Give them, put it in their backpacks when they get to school, and they can walk around with them. Just like that kid that took the gun to school yesterday. That 9 millimeter. But they had the wrong gun. It had the wrong bullet, so he couldn't use it. He was waving it and killing everybody. I mean, wouldn't you be afraid to come into school if you know that a 6-year-old had a snub nose in his backpack?
Of course. But, you know, scared of the whole idea. I mean, I'm scared of, I grew up with teachers. My grandmothers and my mother were both teachers. I grew up in schools teaching. I teach. And let me promise you, last people on earth that need weapons are teachers. It's ludicrous on its face. They need to be focused on education and teaching children and not spending money, time, and effort learning how to be paramilitary, you know, strike force. It's stupid on its face. It can't work. It won't work. It's dangerous. And sooner or later, they're going to either accidentally shoot or a child will get hold of the one of the weapons and accidentally shoot somebody. It's going to be a tragedy, just unbelievable tragedy. You know, somebody, they don't think these things through, you know, so.
Well,
there's no sense in having weapons in a classroom.
Well, let's chat. We got a caller right here. Let me see who this is on the phone here. Hello, who's this? Caller.
This is Brenda Spencer. How are you, Michael?
How are you, Brenda?
I'm doing great. I was just listening to the conversation. If teachers are already afraid of the students, if you give them a gun, they're going to use it.
I taught. Just like Thomas, I taught 9.5 years at both middle school, high school, and college level.
Right.
There is no way on planet I would touch a teacher with a gun.
That's
no way I trust them.
That's exactly right.
Well, again, it's not their job and not their specialty. They shouldn't be worrying about that. I mean, if we want that kind of situation where they say, okay, we're not going to teach, you know, we're not do the teachers. We'll have trained professional, forces there. We're going to have people that are retired policemen or straight out of the military, and they'll be guarding every student. Yeah. Well, then let's just cut to the chase and go ahead and put them all in maximum security prisons. I mean, that's what you're talking about.
Right.
They'll be safe. I mean, you know.
I have a girlfriend that's a teacher that is taking her children out of school to homeschool them.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, hey. Absolutely.
Because
that's right.
They're safer.
They're safer.
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be this way. We don't need to spend, you know, billions of dollars arming every teacher in America. It's ridiculous. As Mike and I talked about several months ago when Newtown first happened, one of the other sides of it that they don't ever talk about, you know, they say, hey, let's arm every teacher and let's train them all. We'll pay for that. You know, we're Republicans. Rah, rah, let's go. But it's not just that. You have to reinforce every classroom. You have to put in special lockers for the guns that are not, you know, you can't break into them. Then you're going to have to reinforce the walls and the glass and the doors, because if anybody shoots a weapon in a school, it'll go through four classrooms before it stops, you know.
Absolutely.
These things are, anyway, they don't think you're going to have to rebuild every, you know, make every room a safe room, and it's going to cost trillions to do that.
Well, but that's very simple. I mean, that's simple. Listen, here's the thing that I don't understand is they want to do this. They want all these kids, all these people to come into the schools to be armed. They didn't say how the U.S. government was going to pay for
it. Well, maybe the NRA.
They said that it would cost, in Chicago, $200 million. But that's Chicago. Chicago is half the size of the school system in New York City. We have 1.5 million teachers.
Well, you've already seen those estimates. They've already done preliminary estimates that it would cost hundreds of billions of dollars just to do the major school systems across the country. But that, again, that was only the training and hiring of just additional security guards. That wasn't teachers. That wasn't anything. And that was just major school systems. I mean, it's...
So, let them do that as long as the NRA pays.
Hey, let them donate all their profits.
Let them donate
profits
it.
For children. Donate the profits for the safety of children.
That's right.
And give them a tax write-off. Let them rebuild the schools. But you see, what they also want to do is they want to also be the ones that hire the guards. Now, Asa Hutchinson, the former congressman or senator.
Oh, I saw him on TV the other night.
Yeah, right. He just put through a report that he was commissioned to do, to find out what was needed. Oh, by the way, the report was commissioned and paid for by the NRA.
Right. And then remember, what was that finding? What was that thing he said we need to hire? Him.
We need to hire him.
Thank you.
We need to hire him. That's right. We need to hire him and all his buddies. And when he was asked that question by, I believe it was Lawrence O'Donnell, he said, how much does it cost? He didn't answer. He says, well, we're not going to tell you. You don't need to know. Well, wait a minute.
Exactly right.
What kind of answer is that?
That is crazy.
Well, that's kind of like, hey, Mike, it's kind of like the Iraq War. It'll pay for itself. It's magic.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It'll pay for itself.
Well, you know what?
If
we could just have each child chip in their lunch money, it'll pay for itself.
Well, I always thought that. Why not their lunch money?
Those
they
that have lunch money.
Lunch
money.
Those that have lunch money.
We have some that do not have lunch money.
We're not talking about all the freeloading, all those children we need to throw in the street. We're not talking about those losers.
But that's only one of the issues, because you saw what Tennessee is doing. They are passing a law in Tennessee that any child that fails in class that's on welfare, their welfare check will be cut.
Wow.
Did you hear that? That happened in Jersey. Yeah. If your child, because they blame the parent, because if the child doesn't pass in school, it's the parent's fault. And if you're on welfare, you are not doing anything. So therefore, you should be at home helping that child pass.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind, maybe the parent never had the education to help that child pass, but they're going to cut the welfare check.
Well, that's another thing, Mike. If the parents aren't married and then they don't have education, let's cut them off of any aid, too. They're just a burden on society.
Well, you see, and here's the other thing. The welfare is only $5,000 a year. So that means
a year.
If it's cut a year.
Mm-hmm.
A year. Did you hear me?
Wow.
A year.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
wow.
What does that come out to be? Let's see. It ain't good. It ain't good. How
I'm just
you
saying,
live
you're not,
on five,
you're not doing one, much for $5,000.
No.
Yeah.
But it better like the taste of water.
It costs me more than $5,000 for air in my tires a year. This is just completely insane. But this
Mike, you want all the listen, Mike. The problem with you is you want all the fancy stuff, and you have like electricity. You know, you're just a waster.
You mean I just can't burn the kerosene lamp anymore?
No.
Wow, it's just sad, isn't it? Though it's sad that this is the conversation. This is the solution that we're having. You know, let's kick people off welfare and let's put the money toward arming teachers. It's insane.
I have. How long can you stay on, Thomas?
Oh, I can stay on for a while, sir. I am just touring the disaster zone of the South.
Yes, because I was telling the people at the house here last night. Here, Thomas, I don't know if you can call in because there, since the all the disruptions down there in the on the Gulf Coast, that the only one that has electricity is in the governor's mansion in Mississippi.
Well, yeah, because I was a Republican in at the time. But yeah, actually, you know, Mike, it's not too terribly funny. I'm down here on the Gulf Coast. I'm traveling through the Katrina zone, and it is still devastated, even though the Congress back then, you know, gave money instead of blocking it like they were doing this Congress. But they still have terrible devastation. There's you know, every just one in ten businesses are built back. There's just nothing but empty lots. And I've actually had terrible reception with my phone. I keep losing signal and Wi-Fi, and I can't access internet and stuff. So it actually is true. It's very devastated down here, and it's lagging behind. And we're talking years after Katrina, but it's not a funny situation. It's very sad.
But they love it down there, and they love their governors. So that's wonderful, right?
Wow.
Well, hold about.
It'd be better if we had
guns. I'm very glad. Brenda?
Yes, I'd like to know who the gentleman is that I am speaking with, other than you, Michael.
Well, that's my Thomas Thornberry. He's my senior producer.
Okay, very good. Thank you very
Hello,
much.
Hello, madam. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm just on the road at the time.
Okay. Very good.
I am Thomas, last week I was given the opportunity to be the MC of a fabulous Easter show that Brenda put together for the Ivy Chapter 126 and the who
Order
was the other
Eastern
one?
Eastern Stars.
The Order of the Eastern Star.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, wow.
It was down in Troy.
Okay.
It was Order of Troy, New York. Troy, North Carolina. And it was fabulous. And I couldn't stay for the whole thing because I had to come back and be involved with something at my church that I, because I'm the communications chair. And so, but I was there. I was able to start the program off, and it was really, she's going to send me the DVD and video, right, Brenda?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Miss Brenda, I commend your bravery in letting him near a microphone. But you go right ahead.
Yeah.
Apparently you didn't know you were getting
injured. He loves the mic, doesn't he?
Listen,
a little
don't
bit,
say
a
that. They told me, they said, hey, listen, the program is running long already. Can you cut it short? I said, oh, gee, yeah, okay.
This is why your mom named you Mike.
Is that what?
Oh, that is good.
Thank you.
That is a good one.
So Brenda, tell us about the show. How did it go?
It went very well, and we've been asked to do it again next year.
Oh,
great.
Is that right?
We've been asked to do it again next year.
Was going on?
The theme the 12 tribes exodus. And my husband made an ark. One of my members of the order made the golden calf that was made out in the wilderness. And, I mean, we had tribal leaders. We had the flags for each tribe.
We had tribal, I mean, leaders and members. I mean, it was beautiful. And I selected the music to use when they would come out of Egypt. I sang Go Down Moses in the darkness so that the lights could come on right after I sang that. I mean, it was just really beautiful. Actually, it was to raise money also to help with some of the young people in our community and surrounding communities.
Very nice.
That's what we do this every year. We put on a program every year to do something for our community and for college students that are going to college.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
Yes,
and,
thank you.
Well, that's one of our favorite topics here, education and helping kids
yes.
grow, you know?
Yes.
And this was the – is this the Jesse Lee Rennick Turner Scholarship
this
Fund?
My mother was named mm-hmm. Jesse Lee Rennick Turner, mm-hmm. and she was the first person that I had ever seen do the 12 tribes, but she didn't go out as far as I did. And she didn't. She just did it right in their church. So when she passed, I said I wanted to do a Jesse Lee Rennick Turner Foundation. Really haven't
wow,
been able
nice.
To get it off the ground the way I wanted to, but it takes time. But
yes,
what I'm doing this I did this program in her name to honor her.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
And when we distribute what monies that we can, I will mention her name. I most certainly will, because she was the songbird of Stanley County, parts of New York. I mean, my mother could really, really sing. If she had had a chance like some other people, she would have been famous. But, you know, I look back on that and I say she did just what she was supposed to do.
Well,
right.
Let's don't talk about singing, because right now I want you to hear something that Brenda did.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good time. Hallelujah. Jesus died on Friday.
That sounds like Richard.
And he rose on. He appeared and reappeared.
Michael, I love that song.
Now,
but
that was Richard's
song, and I was in the background with another young man by the name of Ike.
Right.
That's Richard's song.
That
was nice.
You know, I have the this was a song, okay, that it wasn't a song I intended to play.
We worked on that song a long time trying to get that together.
That was a beautiful song. He has a very nice voice.
The arrangement is fabulous on that, and I'm looking now to get your songs up
and running.
So here's a question for you, though. Are these songs that are existing, or are these songs that y'all wrote yourselves?
Richard wrote that song, and we put the background, made up the background to it.
Right.
Ike and I made up the background to it.
That Ike Turner? That one?
No, I don't wish that. No, this is a young man that we go to church together here in Albemarle at Resurrection Community Church, and he's the sound man. And he sings, and I sing, and Richie called us into the studio. He was doing this song, and he needed some background. And so we came in and just sat down and started listening, and we just started singing that background, and it all fell together.
Wow, nice.
Yes.
That was a beautiful production. It sounded professional, and it's a really good song. You could hear
we have a very powerful technician. His name is Bernard Joe Dodge from E&I Studios. He is the best. I thought y'all were going to put up a
YouTube video or something of it. Have a channel of all your songs.
I hope so.
You should do that.
As a matter of fact, you guys didn't do a YouTube or not?
Not on that one.
That is because it's really
good. Well, you can put up the audio on it, but you really should. It'd be a nice thing.
Okay. Very good.
I'm going to have yours up in just a minute here.
Okay. I'm working on my next CD now, and prayerfully all the songs will be original. My first CD was my first try. I just did everybody else's my way.
Right.
I did their songs my way, but then Richard Pratt, told me, no, he says, you're going to start doing your own songs. So I said, okay, and that's what I started doing. So I'm working on that now.
Excellent.
And that's
impressive. Yes.
The songs that are on this album called Hallelujah. No, it's not called Hallelujah. Is that the one? No, your song, Visions of Heaven. Visions of Heaven. And Hallelujah is Richard's. And there is one song on here that I am trying to get up right now. And I thought I had it in here, but I didn't have it loaded. But it'll just be up in a minute. But tell us something about what went on after I left at the 12 tribes.
After we finished, you know, when the children of Israel were in the wilderness complaining about being hungry, they start complaining about being hungry, and we had angels to come out to serve the manna to the audience.
Mm.
And they brought the food out and put it in front of the audience, and they began to eat, and the play went on. After the play, we had a drawing, and we had one winner. We only drew once. And after that, I mean, everyone would just start talking to us and telling us how much they enjoyed it. They wanted to hear more singing, of course. But at that time, it was really time to go home. That's when we realized that we're going to have to do it again next year. And then I had to turn my ringer off Sunday because the phone consistently rang. It consistently rang.
Right.
I enjoyed it. You should do it next year. Oh, I had something. I think I'm going to be in it for you next year. And I said, I'm going to use the same people I use.
That's the kind of messages you'd want to hear.
Yes, it is.
That's good.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I enjoyed doing it, but I tell you, it was very trying. Very trying. Now, the year before last, we did one called Thrilogy. Mm-hmm. Thrilogy was just, I just invited different singers from different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And that went over very big because people love singing.
Yes.
They love singing. And I was really leery about as to whether they would come out to see this play put together by just one of the local people. But
right.
we had a good mm-hmm. crowd. They were still coming in when you left, Michael.
Is that right?
Yes, it was packed.
Oh, my gracious.
It was a packed house.
Well, I am very glad. I am really glad that all those the things that you put together
yes.
could come up. And
yes.
Now, where when after I left, after mm-hmm. I think it was after Richard did his last song, how did it proceed from there?
Well, when Richard did, you left before the play started, didn't you?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. When Richard did his song, then I was the last, no, the rap artist was the last one to sing.
Oh, okay.
Were you there when the little young fella went
no.
up and did the rapping? Okay, you were there when I sang.
Yes, I was there when you sang.
Okay,
correct.
My song was Higher Ground. I just, mm-hmm. my message to the people at that time was, we have come a long way, but we still have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
We still need to keep learning. We still need to keep working. We still need to keep striving. We still need to keep pushing. That's why I sang Stevie Wonder's song, Higher
mm-hmm.
Ground. People
right,
keep learning. People keep warring because powers of the world are lying. Brothers and sisters are mm-hmm. dying.
Hello?
Teachers, keep teaching.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, preachers, keep preaching. Believers, keep believing because the world keeps turning, and it won't be long. So this was my message at that time. And after I did that, the young rapper came up, and he rapped about a revolution being televised. And someone said, oh, the revolution of the Lord is not going to be televised. I said, you don't know that.
It could be televised.
With
technology?
You know,
it seems like I've seen that before. Absolutely.
Yes, you're right. Who would have ever thought I would have ever seen? I lived in New York. I didn't even see the Black Panthers when I lived in New York, but I saw them on television since I've been in North
mm-hmm.
Carolina.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Can you believe it? So you never know what you're going to
you
see.
You never know. That's
you
absolutely
never know
correct.
What you're going to see. So you don't know what these young fellas are talking about. They may know something we don't know. We have to keep learning.
We have to keep learning. That's absolutely true.
And
but
if they're giving us something that's decent and in order without a whole lot of, killing in it and a whole lot of sex things talking about, because I wouldn't have that on my program anyway, and this young man knew this. So he did a very, very good job. His song was very digestible for the people there. And after go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's so important what you're saying about accepting and bringing in the new generation, the next voice, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, people forget, but not too long ago, swing and jazz was the revolution and the thing that was banned and
that's
that nobody
right.
wanted to hear.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
not,
exactly
you know, that's
right.
just time. Time moves on and change.
Time
it changes the only
on
constant.
And it waits for no man.
That's
it
right.
Waits
time
no
waits
man.
For no man. Well, you know, it's surprising that you said that because when I was doing the interview, which we're going to play a little later,
mm-hmm.
Richard, we talked about the use of the language back that Blue Magic used,
yes.
and how it was so warm and,
yes,
and cuddly
yes.
and loving,
yes.
So I said, well, and then we got today. With your pants past your butt.
I know.
And the words are, get the hell out of my face. You know, I mean, but now, and that means love, if you say that to a young lady. I mean,
yeah.
What, are you kidding me?
Isn't that horrible? That's horrible. That's horrible.
Well,
that's that generation. But I guarantee you, if they live as long as we have lived, they will feel the same way about that as we do about it right now. Because some of those same things were said to us about the way we wore our clothes.
Right. Well, you know, now the thing is that I guess it depends on where you were. You see, I went to Catholic school, so I don't remember a time, except I don't remember when I got to college was the time when I stopped wearing a tie. I wore a tie because we had a dress and uniform, so I wore a tie all through elementary school. And I continued it when I was in high school. So, you know,
I
wore the
used to have
shirt.
To be dressed.
Yes. Yes.
What's that? You what?
Yes.
You say what? What were you saying? Who used to be dressed? Thomas.
I wore mini skirts.
Oh.
My mother hated them. And when I would leave the house, my skirt would be down below my knee. By the time I got to school.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah, you know. But now I look at it and it's disgusting. I say, you know, our young ladies, where are they? I'm sure they were saying the same thing about us.
Of course.
They said the same thing.
Look, telling earlier, my grandfather, when I was growing up, still wore hats and everything. And he got very mad and disgusted. He used to say that Kennedy killed the hat industry. But he used to get mad when he would go out and all the young people and everybody, you know, all the businessmen around town didn't have hats on and stuff.
That's
and were
right.
just going around. And he said, it just looks so, you know, he said, look at all these slouchers and everything. He just didn't like it. Yeah, because they dared not wear a full suit or a hat, you know.
That's
just changing times. I mean,
someday
they'll be laughing at us that, you know,
yes,
our pants were up. You know,
yes,
we had our
will.
Pants buckled up.
And look at the hippies and the flower children. They're grown and gone. You know, they're grown now. I bet you when they look back on that, they just shake their head and say, what was I doing?
Well,
no,
well
they got the easy out. They actually look back and they don't remember what they were doing.
They were too zooted.
But the thing is now, what I want to know, since you said that now, Brenda,
yes.
Did you ever get caught with that dress above your knee?
Yes, I did. And believe me, it was my last time. I had one of my mothers
that
did not play.
I do not believe that was the last time. Don't tell me that.
It was while I was in school.
Is that right?
Yeah, because I'm telling you, my mother didn't play.
Well, since you were saying that.
But also, you know,
when
you get older, you get more modest. That just happens.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Well, since you said that, I guess this song by you has to work fine.
Okay. All right.
Appear the far, and grace will lead me on home. Lead me on home, Lord, lead me home. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun.
So now you see.
Now I see. Yes.
I'm sure that's what your mother told you.
Yes. Thank you so much. Yes, I do see.
How did you get to come up with the arrangement for this?
I heard the Five Blind Boys, and they had a similar arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always loved to take a song apart and put it back together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did with that one. I took the House of the Rising Sun and took their version and made my version. So that I did. I have three versions going there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I can you can
so it,
hear
it became the House
the
of the Rising
version.
Brenda.
Exactly.
You can hear the different versions, and which was so I was so great.
Thank you.
Where did you record this at?
I did that in E&I Studios in Troy, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay.
Richard Pratt and Ben Dodge Studio.
Ah,
E&I.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, in Troy.
Mm-hmm.
Sure did.
And when did you put this together? When was this?
This was in 2011 when I did that CD.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And
congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
It was really fabulous.
Thank you. How many
people are on? Are you
on
doing
that one?
On that one.
I do all those voices. All the voices. Now, Richard and I have one on there also, somehow, some way. And he does the lead, and I do the lead, and I do the background.
Ah, okay.
Well, I love background. I love harmony. And I was blessed to be able to harmonize.
Well, there's another one here. I think, let me see if I can pull it up here, that you might be able to
hear. I'm impressed that she's like a one-lady band here.
Awesome. Thank you. And for years I did a cappella. I have one CD with nothing but a cappella on it.
Wow.
But once I went in the studio, that was the end of it. Richard said, no more a cappella.
Okay.
Well, here's my request thought of the moment while Mike's looking for stuff.
Okay.
Get together a group of a quartet of ladies and do a barbershop lady quartet.
Ah! Now that would be beautiful.
That's,
it would be,
that's a beautiful sound. That's a beautiful sound. You cannot beat it. And
yeah,
I used to sing with
it.
A group of ladies called the Harmonizing Sisters. And we were going places, but, you know, after a while, you get a bunch
but,
of women
you know,
together, you know what happens.
Life goes places. That's what happens.
Yeah, right.
Well, there is, I'm looking for this other one, if I can pull this up here, that I just want everyone to hear, and I'm looking for it right now, because there's so many on here that I hadn't pulled up. Well, just keep talking. I'll find it. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Yeah, so, which is, now, why did you pick Amazing Grace?
Because it was Amazing Grace. It was the grace of God. That brought me from where I was to where I am and to where I was at that particular time when I did that song. And my mother was sick during that time. And I just, that was it. And I didn't want to do it the old way. I didn't want to do it the old way. People are so, actually, if you do it in church the old way, you don't get to sing it. Everybody takes it from you.
Oh,
right. So I wanted them to really hear the words. And I said, if I do it this way, they don't know it this way. And they'll have to listen.
And if I could pull this up here. Now, you have on here Visions of Heaven.
Yes.
How did you come up with that?
My mother passed.
You know, Visions of Heaven.
My mother passed, and I just had visions of heaven. I know that's where she is.
Mm-hmm.
And on my new CD, I have a song on there, Tell My Mother I Said Hello.
Nice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's where
I think you're doing a beautiful thing with these. They're all tributes, but this
yes.
whole idea of the charity, the memorial, the
yes.
songs for everything, you're doing a
yes.
beautiful thing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank
you very much.
Now, there are, let's see if I can see what this one is. Okay.
Change.
This might be it. What's that?
I bet it's change. Change is
well,
going to come.
Well, if I can
yep.
if I can get it up here, we will hear it in a micro minute.
Okay.
Yes. You know, I love that song.
I
so,
know you do.
They have a, yeah, I got to convert it to an MP3 here. And I thought I did this last night, and I did, but it's
yeah, you know
the
what
wrong
they said
file.
About
the
technology,
code.
Mike? It's only as good as the user.
It's only good if you use it. But see, they were in MP3 4, they should have been in MP3, MP3s. You see, that was the story. But we'll be right there in a minute. But now, the change, now I'm trying to think, didn't you and Richard sing this last year
at the Black Leadership Caucus,
right?
We sang Somehow Some Way.
Oh,
that's on my CD too. Somehow
yeah,
Some Way is
on there. Too.
Yep. Yes.
Somehow Some Way on here
yes.
too. And if I can find this one, I will pull that one.
But
up
I
also.
Did. Change is gonna come alone. I always do that as a solo. Nobody ever sings that with me. Nobody.
If I can, let's see, what the heck is it at here? I will pull that up. And sorry, we're having this problem with it here. I should have been. I wanted to see.
And
the
I have to give. I have to thank Mr. Pratt. If Mr. Pratt hadn't pushed me to where I am now, I think I probably would have been sitting home pouting about my mother.
Is that right?
Yes. I don't know how it happened. He just started talking to me about, you know, God gave you this voice. You need to use it. Your mother's gone.
Yeah.
You know, and he needed some backup for one particular song, this one particular song that we were supposed to learn to do for a program that Sister Standback was having. And she wanted that song. So we went in the studio. We were going to try to do it a cappella. And it didn't work. So I called Luther Bond's music minister.
I just went through the computer and went to the internet and found him and found the minister of music for Luther Barnes, because that was his song. And we weren't going to do it the same way, because, like I said, I can tear a song up and put it back together. And so when I spoke with her, she gave us permission to do it if we critiqued it the right way. Then she wanted us to send her a copy of it, and we did. And that song, just people just started buying that one CD, just started buying. And then he told me, he said, "Now this is what I'm talking about. You need to go on." And he says, "And you can write." And I swore that I could not write, but after I did the first CD and I did a few concerts for different churches and different organizations, I was laying there one night and words just started coming to me, so I just started writing. Then I began to work on my second CD. Richard pushed me into this.
You can also think now you got a conduit, direct connection upstairs. So
yes, I do.
You're getting a little help. You can write all day long. Yeah.
I can write all day.
Well,
all day
let's
long.
let's just hear what she was talking about.
Okay.
Like that river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long, long time coming, but I know change is gonna come. But I'm afraid to die. Lord, I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long, 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 long time coming, but I know change is gonna come. Knocking me if he did. My Savior, Jesus Christ, and I
Now, that was beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was beautiful. That was really beautiful.
Thank you.
So tell us now, how did this one come about?
The change came after my mother passed, and I began to go out and meet people again and sing. It was like that was a closeness to her.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when I sing, I can actually feel her inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't do things like I used to. I don't even sing like I used to. At one time I worked with only children. Now I work with children and adults.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm working with two young men that just made their three tries, and they're waiting for their call in May to go to the X Factor.
Oh,
so
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, yes. I love it. I love singing.
Well,
I love sharing. I love helping, and I want them to do this. I want these two young men to make it. I worked with the kids at church. One young lady was in my youth choir. She has been to Italy. She's an opera singer now. And, I love spreading what he gave me. And I really didn't realize how much I had until my mother closed her eyes.
Well, that's very true. But, you know, no one knows how much they have until they give it, you know.
Yes.
You just have to reach inside and sometimes let it all loose.
And let it all
but,
go.
Hey, you know, the world didn't know who that Lady Adele was a couple of years ago either. So I think you have a beautiful
voice.
They sure
did, did they?
Thank you.
Didn't
they? Thank you.
They did not know who she was. Until
she's just a no one until children are
married.
That's right.
Absolutely
correct.
And people have been knowing me for years here, but I would always stand in front of the choir singing and direct.
Mm-hmm.
I had worked with them and worked with them. They always saw my back. Now, they saw me in high school singing, soloing and winning all type of contests and going out as a school choir soloist. But that was that was that type of singing. They really forgot that I could sing until my mother closed her eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but see, the kind of singing.
It just came down on me.
Well, the one thing that I want to say, the kind of singing you were just doing, it's the kind of singing. I could just listen to it all day long, but what I wish you would do is put a tape into someone like, you know, B.B. King's hand and say, hey, want to back me up? And let him play the guitar with you. But
want to back me up, huh?
I wish I could do that.
Yeah, you have it, and I think that you could have an immensely huge audience if you wished it. You could certainly have it.
Well, thank you very much. And I'm going to receive that because someone else told me it was going to be.
Was that right?
Yes.
Well,
and,
all you have to do is hear it one time, and you
it's
know
coming.
It's going to be.
Yes, and I believe it's going to be. I don't know. I may not get to do it but once. But I believe that it's going to be.
That's
all it takes. And I never thought of B.B. King. But, you know, my mother sang, you know, my mother, they never heard my mother sing anything except gospel. But my mother had this thing in her voice that was blues and jazz, a mixture.
Well,
and,
that's what, I mean, you got to realize a lot of blues and jazz is gospel. It is
gospel.
That.
It is. And when we were at home, She would sing jazz to me. She would sing gospel to me. She would sing the blues. And then she would also sing, you know, she had all of that.
It all comes from the same place inside.
Yes.
It's the same. The pain and power and glory is all the same. One way you might be saying, you know, there I was stumbling in the church, and the other way you said there I was stumbling in the bar. It's the same. It's the same human and the same, you know.
Yes.
Everything's
you
the
know,
same inside.
That's why when I sing this song At Last by Etta James, I sing it in church because I'm talking about a different type of love.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you
but
know,
that's what I thought. It is the same.
It is the same.
And what I want to do is that we're going to have this. I'm going to have Richard back one time.
Okay.
And I would like to get you both on at the same time
okay.
for our next episode. But I want to play this last tune that, or from your, well, one of the last two. I don't want to play the whole thing because I want to say something. But I love this one too.
Okay. But all right.
Let me say this one thing.
Moses,
way down in Egypt land, tell old Pharaoh to let my people go. When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Thus saith the Lord, bold Moses said, let my people, let my people go. If not, I'll smite your firstborn dead. Let my people, let my people go. Go down, Moses. Way down in Egypt land. And tell old Pharaoh to let my people go. No more shall they in bondage toil. Let my people go. Let them come out with Egypt's spoil. Let my people go. Go down, Moses. Way down in Egypt land. And tell old Pharaoh to let my people, let my people go.
Fabulous, yeah. Fabulous.
Thank you.
And,
that song has come a long way. When I sang it Saturday night, it took on a whole new meaning.
That was in the dark?
In the dark.
Right.
In the dark.
I can't wait to see that
in the dark.
The video on that. And,
yes, thank you.
I want to thank you, Brenda. I want you to stay on because Richard is coming up right now after you.
Okay.
And I'm going to I want to get you because I told Richard after our interview I wanted him to come back.
Okay.
And I think it might be good to have you both back on at the same time.
Okay.
And have it maybe an hour, hour and a half of just you two.
Okay.
I really do.
And
but,
you know what I would love
yes.
to do? I would love to have some of the songs from my new CD with you by that time.
Oh,
fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
That
we
would
can,
be
we
really
can have a, the debut.
Yes. It could be debut.
Of the new material.
That's exactly right.
And I think that would be,
that would be great.
Great. I think that would be great.
That would be great.
I
hope that you're listening. When we do this,
we mean single listening. Of course, I mean listening.
No, not you, Michael.
Oh, yeah. No,
I will definitely.
Here. Okay. He's here with me.
Okay.
He's
all right.
Are you kidding?
So,
I'll be actually now that I got my mind right, I'll be writing a song for you. Don't you worry.
Oh, write me a song. And watch me take it, just take it and do the thing with it.
yep.
Yes,
put the magic in it. That's what you do.
Yes, I will.
Do the magic
in
it.
Well, look, I want you to do me a favor now. I meant it earlier. I want you to send a tape to somebody like BB, but
okay.
I like BB, and BB's
okay.
also, you know, he's getting elderly, and last time I saw him here, he was laughing about having trouble standing all the time, so he had to bring a chair halfway out through
okay.
his concert. You know, you know, to mention the fact that he's been touring for, you know, 500 years.
Yes.
So I think the man's amazing. But I would love to see you just send a tape to somebody like that and say, hey, and no, nothing big. You know, you don't have to appear
right.
on, you know,
right.
the
That's
Academy
right.
Awards show
That's
with them,
right.
but just
no,
say,
I
hey, I want to record a song with you, or I want to do this with you.
Oh,
would you do me the honor? And see what happens.
All right.
Just
I would,
see what
well,
happens.
How in the world, how would I... How would I find out his address?
Oh, you can find
that
out.
That's a wonderful thing called the internet.
Internet. All right. I'm going to do this, and the minute I do it, I'm going to let Michael know so that he can let you know.
Okay.
Oh,
okay.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. I want you to listen to this. We got now Mr. Pratt, Richard Pratt.
Okay.
Coming right up. So you stay and listen, Brenda.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
My pleasure.
Friday,
that has to be one
April
of
the 5th, 2013, and this is
yes.
The Last Word with Michael Lawson.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Fortenberry is out on the coast of Mississippi with his relatives this Easter. He will probably be calling in if they can get a signal down there. Yes, sir, this is a great show. We have a great guest today, and I want to tell you, if I could stop and start all over again, how many times have you heard that? How many times have I heard that? I mean to tell you, if I could only go back to the day and make it up to you. How many times have you heard that? Can we just stop and start all over again? I know I said that. As a matter of fact, I have had that told to me. And believe me, sometimes, I wish I could stop and start all over again. We have a great treat for everyone today. We are going to have, from that American legend soul music group from Philadelphia, one of the, if not, well, we could put it, there's one or two, but they have to be the one or the two top groups to ever come out of Philadelphia. Blue Magic, I mean, you know, back in the 60s and the late 60s, early 60s, you remember the blue lights, the red and green lights in the basement and the slow music. You grab your girl and you're on the floor with her. Not on the floor, you were dancing on the floor. Well, in some cases, some of you guys might have been on the floor. But I'm telling you, it is a great treat to have this gentleman with us today. And his name is Richard Pratt. Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, how are you, Michael?
How are you?
I'm doing great this morning.
Yes, a little rainy here in Charlotte, North Carolina. But I had a reminisce about this song and the words of this song.
Yes.
I mean, you need to tell us. Back in the day, Philadelphia, when you guys were just starting, I don't know where this record came out at. Where in the group's lifetime did this record come in?
Okay, this is on our first album. Mm-hmm. And you notice I say album, not CD.
Right, right. You need to explain what an album is to some of the people who are listening, because they have no idea.
Well, we're going back a little bit in time. And, the album is the big wax disc that they used to use before the cassette, though the 8-track, the cassette, or the CD. So I guess I'm telling my age, Mike.
Yeah, it's 33 and a third, right?
That's right, exactly. So, a lot of us know exactly what that's about. And some of us today don't have a clue. But music played years ago just as well as it's playing now. And we all grew up, as Michael was saying, we cut off the lights or cut the dim lights, the colored lights. And that's just how we danced when the slow music came on. So it was a wonderful, wonderful time in our music career. But, yeah, I was born and raised in Philadelphia. And that particular time, song, Stop to Start, was on our very first LP. And, we like some of the other Love Valley groups. We
Delphonics,
about,
I guess.
Yeah, Delphonics. Well, out of Philadelphia, we had you know, quite a bit of people that were not just born and raised in Philly, but came into the Philadelphia International recording studios, you know, with Gamblin' Huff and them. So we had a lot of traffic during that time coming into Philadelphia. And, you know, our group was about, you know, talking about the love story between men and women and just how that went. And that particular one is, you know, it's just talking about a guy and a girl. And you know, like you said, I couldn't have said it any better than you did, Michael. It's just, you know, can we just start all over again? Yeah. And it just fit right in with the Blue Magic story.
Well, you know, the thing is that I want to get this out of you. To me, now, hey, all right, say I might be considered old school. I mean, you know, like you
Michael
are might
Martin,
be considered
you are
old school.
And so am I.
Well, listen, but I had my grandkids over here last night, and I was downloading some of this music. And he's 4 years old, Blake. He, you know, he's like a mini me.
Uh-huh.
That's what they say he is. And he says, "Can I play my music?" I said, "No, I got to listen to this. We have to listen to this." So his mother was over here, his father was over here. We were having dinner, and my other daughter was over here with my other grandson. And he said, "No, we want to hear this." So my son-in-law, I said, I was playing this Blue Magic. Blue Magic. I don't know Blue Magic. So my daughter says, "Yeah, well, I know. I think I know Blue Magic." I said, "Yeah." As soon as I put the song, he goes, "Oh, I know that. That's Blue Magic." I said, "Yeah, that's Blue Magic." So he said, "Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know the name of it, but I know that. That's a bad song." So I said, "Well, wait a minute. Now here's a song that you sit down to. You can hear every single lyric, every single nuance. Today, if you don't have an interpreter, how the hell do you understand what's going on? The music is played twice as loud as the vocalist." I don't know, trying to cover up his voice quality. I don't know. In most cases, yes. But tell me, back in the day, there seemed to be more passion in the songs and the lyrics.
But
you
know, it's good that you mentioned that, because just from my observation before and now, I just think there was more passion, and people were more in love, and you know, we had that the greater institution of marriage, you know, responsibility to your missus, you know, versus today. The young men just in their songs, they just really don't have that respect for women. I mean, and they just say things derogatory. They just don't say it right. Years ago, I mean, we had pride in the young ladies that we were dating or that were chasing, you know. And it was just such a respect there. So, with saying that, you know, we were gentlemen.
Oh.
You know, today versus, and I hate to say this, young folks, but today it's like thugs. It's like everything you say has to be harsh and mean and to the point.
Well, I want to play one more. I want to play a piece from that song we just heard to bring emphasize what you just said. Hold on just a minute. Now, you see, in this song, I mean, in the first line, the guy is looking at the young lady, and he knows that she has a problem. And he's so concerned. He says, what's come over you? You know, well, come on, tell me. Well, we can work this out. You don't hear that anymore. You don't hear that anymore.
Get up out of my face.
You know, this and that. Get up out of my face. You know, that sort of stuff. And now it's, hey, come on.
It's you know, it really, to me, has an impact all across the world. You know, because music is such a gift. And
oh, absolutely.
Sometimes, you know, sometimes you can say things in music and it's heard. It's like it's magical. It's just heard. Now, versus saying something, you know, over the air or maybe in front of a crowd, you're speaking something. It has a different text to it. And people, so when you say something in music, you know, we have to be very, very careful, because that's going out all around the world, and especially these days.
With the internet, satellite,
it's everywhere.
Right. And
so if we go ahead.
Yeah, no, the thing is that it's the way, you know, it's just like this regressive Republican Party. They're trying to now say, oh, you know what, it's the way we said the things that we have to change. Well, yes, that's part of it, but the problem is you have to do indeed also. And it is in this song, What's Come Over You, you know, they're trying to work it out. He's just not trying to say, hey, believe me what I'm saying. I'm going to show you. You know, I'm going to show you a deed. And, you know, this is the thing in today's music. If you're the bad boy thug, that proves your love. But how does that prove your love when you call it? Your girl you love so much, the B word, and then you say, get up out of my face.
Yeah. You know, it's completely different language. And I just don't understand how the young ladies accept that.
Oh, well, I would be
embarrassed to tell someone I'm interested in or I love. Those kinds of things.
In today's society, we have a sort of a mentality that, you know, everything is for everybody. The individual is for himself and not for anybody else. And you need to make sure that you can set up things for yourself, because if I can't get things for myself, I can't get things for nobody. Well, you know, that's not true. It is not. Back then, you were partners, you know?
Exactly.
And it wasn't like a three-ring circus.
Mississippi. He's just a face painted all in smiles.
About the circus clown, because you know he was up until this year. He's still a little afraid of clowns, you know.
Right.
So he says, "I said no, he's not really a clown. He's saying that he's trying to hide his face because you know he's sad, you know, like a clown." He said, and he says, "Oh," he said, "but why is he sad?" I said, "Well, you have to listen to the song." So, again, we come to another song, which I just love this song. I mean, this is, and of course, my son-in-law says, "I know that song, too. That's Blue Magic." I said, "Yes." I said, "Well, now, this is the same grandson that I think I mentioned to you before, that when he was 2 years old, came over to where my TV is, and I still have a 8-track deck that is in working order." Mm-hmm. And I got some eight-track Temptation album there, a Four Top album there. I had the Sideshow album there. And he went in and started taking the tape out of the Sideshow album. Out of the eight-track. He says, "Look,
yeah,
tape."
You're definitely telling your age.
Yeah, but it works.
But it's all good. It's all good.
But they all work. And it plays good. It works and it plays good. So I don't have that album anymore. I don't have it. I said, "Why did you do that?" He says, "It was tape." I said, "Yes, it was tape. And now it's no good."
So it was classic tape, too.
It was classic tape.
That was a collector's item, yeah.
Oh, I bet you. Well, my deck is a collector's item because it still works.
Mm-hmm.
It is fabulous. So tell us something about this three-ring circus. Put together.
You pretty much summed it up. You know, our first biggest hit was Sideshow. And
yes.
That was kind of a follow-up to that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and plus sometimes when you're writing, you kind of want to introduce things that people are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're listening to the story, you know, they can put themselves right in there, you know, because a lot of us in the love story of our lives have, you know, witnessed some of the hardships that partnership brings, you know, some of the wonderful, wonderful blessings that partnership brings. And so, you know, three-ring circus is just telling that life is a three-ring circus. You have your ups, your downs, like a carousel. But as we grew up, we stayed with our partners through ups and downs.
Right.
You know, whereas today, because of the way that the dialogue is going across the globe, it's sending bad messages, wrong signals to the couples of now. Don't misunderstand me, folks. There are many couples who are staying together. There are many couples who are still in love. There are many couples
through ups and downs. Through plenty of ups and downs.
Through plenty of ups and downs. So this is not an impossible thing. What life is, three-ring circus, is like Brother Lawson just said. It is showing us and letting us know that it's not always going to be rosy. It's not always going to be peaches and cream. You're going to have this. I mean, expect this in your relationships. But still, you know, have respect for your partner, because it wouldn't be your partner if you didn't see something in there that really touched you, and vice versa. So we're being told, you know, the secrets of life. And so when these things come, you don't get blown out of proportion.
Well,
but
you're absolutely correct. You know, the thing is that you have some people, so even back then, who just a little bit of adversity and they ran for the hills. They didn't want to face anything, you know, and eased one partner, told the other partner, hey, listen, don't worry about it. We'll face it together. They still couldn't do it. But today,
and you know, Michael, that's not to cut off, but that's one of the important things of the Blue Magic saga of the love song, that we try to help bring that out in the open, because a lot of times, you know, love affairs, as you mentioned, they go south because people don't just buy into what it is that, you know, that they wanted to do. Usually, your first impression of a woman or woman of men and the whole relationship thing, you know, when you vibe on that special someone, then, you know, and I don't want to put this in, but I'm going to say it this way. God blesses you with that. And
yep.
and when doing it, so that's a good thing. What happens is when we start leaning on our own understanding, and especially the days where it's a little bit harder because you don't have that encouragement where you had in our day, you had Delphinus, you had Manhattans, you had Temptations, you had Supremes, you had, you know, Marvin Mandel, you had different ones telling. Smokey Robinson, yeah, different ones telling these stories that kept you encouraged. You know, today it's a whole other dialect. Today it's like, forget her, forget him. You know, go do what you have to do. Go do your own thing. And it's really has damaged. And I am praying so much that they would. I know this is an episode in music. But I can't wait till they put the old school style in way of commercial back on the air.
And that leads me to another one of my favorites I'd like everyone to listen to.
Remember.
I want to tell you, now, to me, this song seems like it's a follow-up to What's Come Over Me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you
mm-hmm.
know, after you say, you know, oh, what's come over you, what's come over me, all right, let's stop and start all over again. I mean, here you are. This is when you're in love with someone and you're speaking to, you know, I sound like a psychologist now. When you're sitting there and you're talking to someone and you're having this fight and or you're not having a fight, you seem to be estranged, one on one side of the room or one side of the bed or the other, and you're not speaking, hey, you know, what's come over you? Let's stop and start all over again. I mean, that's my impression.
Yeah, well, and see, this is what, you know, in love affairs, this is what you do because, you know, we have been brought up sometimes in the wrong thinking that everything sooner or later becomes picture perfect and everything is correct.
Right.
Well, no, that's not true. We're always going to have differences of opinions because when you do pick someone, they are pretty much the opposite of you, and that's what makes the balance between the two of you becoming
right.
What one doesn't have, the other has. You know, vice versa. So you're going to have opposition in your love affair because that's what you invited into it. But that's
absolutely
natural, and that's okay.
Absolutely.
At the end of the day, whatever differences you should have, you should always somebody should apologize. Someone has to be the
yeah.
person.
Right. How many times? Say that one more time. Somebody what?
Somebody needs to apologize. Be the bigger person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to be. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Finish.
Yeah. You know, and it's sometimes, you know, and I can speak for men. Sometimes our egos are sometimes outside of the room. And again, this is what we've always, you know, we're inspired as children to be the best, to be the, you know, the, and I want to say that, the best. Now, what happens when you're not the best? You know, so we don't know how to take things. And so we get into this dominating atmosphere, a personality, and we need to be able to control that. You know, a woman does want someone domineering, but not controlling, not abusive. You know what I mean? And sometimes we take that to another phase because we won't apologize or we won't admit that we're wrong in certain cases. You know, and men, we got to realize that we're not always right. And when you got in tune with that young lady, you knew she was bringing another part to you. So let us not be big-headed.
Well, you're absolutely correct. There are so many men out there who see a woman that is smart or smarter than them or has got a better or bigger job than them, and they run for the hills.
They run for the – or they treat them really bad. When a woman is so sweet and special, and she doesn't go through that. A majority of women do not go through – the money situation, that they share their kind, and they're looking for a good mate. They're looking for a good man. But, yes, just what you said, if she's making an excellent amount of dollars more than us, she has a bigger position, we get, I don't know if it's inferior with that, we get a complex about that or whatever, and then, again, we may even date her, but we're going to abuse her. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Because we can't handle that, and that's wrong. And she's willing to share the world with you, but we become fools. You know, it's in our teaching. But like you're talking about, Michael, these are the things that men have to be aware of. You know, you don't have to be macho man all the time.
And it is not a sign.
Step further, hurry, hurry, before the show begins.
And that was nice, and we are going to come back to Richard next week because we have part two of our interview with Richard Pratt. And right now we are going to be going to Mr. Thomas Fortenberry, who's still on the phone with us, and we also have, let's see who else we also have. Oh, we have Mr. George Gaffney on the phone with us from Simpsonville, South Carolina, who is the our man on the aisle. Speaking about our man on the aisle, he passed away yesterday.
Yes, and do you see the article they had? They had a joke in the paper about that. They said, now he's trying to see if heaven will give him two thumbs up.
No, I didn't see that.
I'm telling you now, I don't want to talk on this show because I just want to hear Richard talk and some more music, because I'm telling you, that is, I'm sitting here damn near in tears. I'm telling you, those, when you reminisce and talk about what's playing out there now and what we grew up listening to.
Oh, God, please. We talked about that a little bit with Brenda before, and I don't know if you heard the beginning of the interview with Richard. We talked about that. Did you hear that?
I just heard everything he said. I mean, it was just, you know, and the songs that played. I'm telling you, it's very emotional because you look back and, man, I'm telling you.
Yeah, well, as I said at the beginning of the interview, I said, hey, listen, you know, you got your girl, you grabbed her close, you got her on the dance floor. Well, not literally. Some of the guys were laying on the dance floor, but I'm talking about dancing on the dance floor. And you would, you know, you tell the girl how much you love her and, you know, wipe the tears from her eyes if she was crying. And in today's song, you say, get the F out of my face. And that's supposed to be love.
You know, I don't mind. And I don't mind when a song has crazy lyrics. Because what I always say, and I've written this to several people, I said, during our time, there was a song where a guy said, this was the lyrics, a wop, bop, a loo bop, a bop, bam, boom. Now,
yeah.
I'm not going to say anything the kids come up with now could be worse than that. And we love Little Richard and everything, but,
yeah.
I mean, that's not a lyric you can walk around and talk to anybody. A wop, bop, a loo bop, a bop, bam, boom.
I'll give
them that craziest. But the hostility that you pointed out.
Yes.
The hostility and the insecurity. You know, when I was teaching school, at one school they had a boy, and they said, Mr. Gaffney, we got this guy in, and we got to get him in your class. We want him to come to you twice a day and stuff like that. And I said, well, why? They said, well, wait when you see him. And the kid came in, and he had his fist balled up. He walked around the school with his fist balled up. And they said, what do you think about him? I said, well, I'll try to tell him not to be scared. And he said, scared? Everybody's scared of him. I said, no, no. If he has his fist balled up, he's scared. I said,
yeah, he's scared
he
of
was, that. You know, there's a great scene in, I forgot what movie it is now, but where these guys, three guys are in jail having lunch. You know, they're in the cafeteria. One guy has his arm wrapped around his food, and he's eating. One guy forgot to get like a loaf of get a slice of bread or something, so he warns everybody not to touch his plate while he's up there getting the bread, and the other guy gets up and goes to get his bread and doesn't say anything. And then I say, well, which one of these guys is the toughest? And it's the guy who just got up and went and just got his bread, because his thing was, hey, nobody's going to bother my stuff. The other guy's got his arm around it. One guy's got to tell you, don't touch it, or, you know, he's got to threaten
right.
you. This guy just
right.
gets up and goes and gets his bread, because the thought that somebody's even going to touch his plate while he's gone doesn't enter his mind.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and this kid walking around the school with his fist ball up, I said, he's scared. And me and this kid never had a problem. He settled down, stuff like that, because, you know, people don't realize it. So I'm just saying that these songs with these lyrics that are just so hostile to women and so, as Richard Bruce talked about, of being aggressive or something like that is an insecurity
there.
Yeah,
it's false bravado.
It is. That's right.
And some well-known revisionists of tax reform wrote me a short story about it. He says, I just received a letter from the IRS. It puzzles me. They are questioning the number of dependents I've claimed. I guess it was because of my response to the question, list all dependents. I replied, 3 million crackheads, 2 million people in over 243 prisons, an untold number of billionaires, 535 persons in the U.S. House and Senate. Evidently, this was not an acceptable answer. I keep asking myself, who the hell did I miss? Missing
Anthony.
Oh, Anthony.
Lord.
Yes.
That's, so, but the thing is, though, the reason why I got, and see, we ran long with Blue Magic and Brenda, and I was fumbling with getting her stuff on the air, but we're going to have them both back and talk about some more stuff. What the hell is going on in Rutgers? I mean, give me a break. Is this a state prison or a state university?
You know, somebody told me, they said something about, well, this is old school. That's not old school.
Old school?
That coaching
hell
is not,
no.
Beating up the players is not old school. You know what I mean?
Give me a break.
That's not old school. This guy is mentally ill.
That's not old Marines.
You know, and that's what I said too. I said, even in Full Metal Jacket, I mean, you know, the guy didn't put his hands on the guys like that. He
hell
punched
no.
the guy in the stomach and everything like that, but not this constant brutality, and just this pervasive atmosphere of hostility and the guy's own psychotic behavior is just, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, when we talked earlier, I told you that, you know, and you agreed, I mean, that the athletic director couldn't survive. You can't survive if somebody's under you. You can't have any kind of program or anything like that for a guy that's, he's over the line so far. You can't rehabilitate him.
Yeah.
Hell no.
No, that's exactly what, that's the problem they ran into with the coach, you know, with all the, I don't know what you want to call it, but pedophilia or whatever he's got,
yeah,
what,
right.
you know,
oh, yeah,
for years and years trying to cover him up because he's a good coach and, you know, oh, so he was in the shower with the kids, don't worry about it, you know, whatever. You can't cover up just crazy, crappy behavior. And that's what this guy, you know.
And, you know, I was told by somebody, I was discussing this, and they said, oh, no, you can't compare that to, you know, to Paterno and this guy. I said, yes, you can. Yes, you can. But see, the only problem is that Paterno was the institution. No, not the people on the board. Paterno was even bigger than them. But here, this guy has a losing record. He has a losing record? Are you joking me? And he's going to do that?
Yeah, because
nobody
would play for the guy. I mean, would you play for a guy beating you up? I mean, come on.
So listen, the president of the school has to go. And that should be up to Chris Christie. This is Chris Christie's house. This is his largest state institution in the entire state. He needs to clean house. And that would give a whole lot of good cred to him if he did. Because that man's got to go. The president knew about this last November. He said, well, I just read it now. That's crap. I don't believe that. The problem is that some of these sports athletic departments have become bigger than the school.
Yeah.
Bigger than the institution. You're bringing in $24 million sometimes and stuff like this.
That's right.
You know, that's
It is big time. I mean, it is. However, they cannot excuse this stuff because what happened, just like in the last case, it didn't come down on one coach. It came down and brought the whole school down. You know, if they let it go, that's what's going to happen.
Well, now, George, what happens now? I believe the athletic coach, not the athletic coach, the president cannot survive this. And then I saw a student who transferred. He's either transferred or he's graduated now. He was on doing an interview this morning. He says, you know, I don't see nothing bad about what he did. You know, you just had to ignore it. And I was there and I ignored it. And I don't feel that he was that much out of line, but he just needs to change. Now, what is wrong with this guy? Is this guy brainwashed?
Maybe he's just the perfect pattern, a person that just is submissive to the point where, you know, he can't see anything else. You know, if you don't have a problem, then you're not a coward or afraid. You know what I'm saying? This guy is somebody who, rather than admit that he, because it sounds like he's a former player or something, for him to be that submissive is the way of avoiding conflict and stuff like that. He, you know, if there's no problem, then
Viet Cong is you break the dog's spirit, it don't bite.
That's it. And so he's trying to just, you know, that's his own thing. He's covering up his own thing. If it wasn't so bad, then he didn't show cowardice or something or timidity by submitting.
Right.
That's his thing, is self-serving.
If it weren't so bad, it wouldn't be on video and people defending it. You know, I mean, come on.
Right. It was,
we wouldn't be talking about that.
That behavior was just unbelievable. And I got to assume this. This guy didn't walk in the gym and coach college first. He had to work with junior high school and high school
Absolutely.
Kids.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, he's been doing this for years.
There was a black AD who resigned, and I can't remember his name. I saw him also late last night, and he said he came in and he saw the tape from ESPN, and he says, I cannot believe this guy was doing this. I cannot believe it. Said he has to go. He said, and you know the thing that's worse? He did this when in summer camp, when 10 and 12-year-olds were coming there. He did a summer camp. He was doing the same thing to the 12-year-olds.
That's I'm telling you, that's not a thing that you just suddenly start.
That's what they call pathological.
Absolutely.
Very pathological.
Now, well, what happened? What would you think would have happened if he threw that basketball and broke one of those kids' wrists, one of his players' wrists? Because that could have easily happened. I mean, this guy was jumping with Louisville, Kentucky, and broke his ankle just coming down wrong. So, I mean, that's very easy. That could have happened. I mean, as a matter of fact, I think now that he was fired, there is going to be major suits against the school.
Of course there will be now. I mean, probably the only reason there hasn't been a lawsuit yet is because he was lucky enough, if you want to say it, that he didn't seriously damage one of them.
Well, no, I think it's because the kids have their scholarships and didn't want to risk them.
Of course not. This guy's just a thug, you know, that's out there abusing kids. I'm saying it's just lucky he hasn't broken somebody's hand or arm or ribs or whatever.
And the other thing I'd say is this. Remember, to the kids, just like in the Army and Navy, anything military, that sergeant that's in charge of you, that's your world. You ain't sitting up here worrying about General Patton and Eisenhower stuff. That sergeant is in charge of you.
And so, therefore,
you know, I mean, the kid's looking at him as the highest authority because that's the athletic director doesn't come down there and tell you to run around the gym or do laps or anything.
That's right.
You look at that. That's the highest authority. That's who you deal with. And so that's God to you. And so the kid can be intimidated by him. And if he hurt somebody, it would still be just when his version would be, it was an accident. I was throwing the ball back and hit Johnny in the head and blacked his eye or something. You know what I mean? That's going to be the thing. He's not going to say I wound up and threw the ball or hit him because he got the layup. So his version is going to be, you know, he's done that. He's hurt.
Yeah.
He's hurt somebody.
Oh, absolutely. Well, did you see his interview today? Did you see his interview today?
I saw the one he did in the street yesterday or something in front of his house.
Oh, is that must be the one. Okay, right. I mean, come on. Give me
a
break.
And you see how his body language, how he kept moving around. He was like a boxer. He was like a boxer, you know, ducking and dodging as he talked to the reporters. He backed up 5 feet, then he moved forward, then he looked to the side, and he's like shifting his thing. His demeanor was not rational.
It's pathological with him.
This guy has got serious problems,
I can tell you, guaranteed, this guy has no coaching ability. He doesn't know what coaching is because he has mistaken, abuse and all. Just like you were talking about the false bravado of a scared kid in school. That's what this guy is. You know, he's the scared coach. He doesn't know how to coach at all.
Well, supposedly though, we were taking it from one of the other coaches said, well, he's a good coach. He just needs to calm him down. Well, he didn't prove it here. He only won 2 games.
I don't care. Look, I'm not even talking about, I don't care about his record. If the kids have won or not won or anything else, he cannot coach because anybody who acts that way and has to abuse people to get them to do something, he can't coach. He's not a leader. He's nothing. I mean, that's like a parent who has to scream and beat their kids to get them to do something. They've already failed if they're at that stage. And when you're abusing the kids that you're supposed to be coaching, you have failed as a coach. The end.
That's very true, I'm telling you. And listen, you get a kid to shoot that ball good enough, you'll win your games no matter what you do. You know,
that's right.
No, exactly.
That doesn't make you a thing. But this guy is this guy is mental ill. I mean, he's mentally ill. Anybody that would abuse anybody like that, you know, there's something wrong with him. There's something wrong with him that you need to abuse people like that.
It is all over. We just ran out of time. We just didn't have enough time to talk about this, but because I got under 2 minutes here. So, hey, I want to thank you guys. We're going to, George, I get you to come back because we need to do a review of you didn't like Temptation, huh?
It was nothing to like or dislike. It's just there. It's in front of you. It's there. An hour and 51 minutes after it starts, it's over. You know.
So
hey, Mike. Hey, Mike. Before we go, I did want to say with him, we should do next week a review of the reviewers because now that Siskel and Ebert are gone, we should do a tip of the hat to them because we have a great reviewer right here, but we ought to honor these guys who my entire lifetime anyway been reviewing movies.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely.
You know,
because
that's also a dying art form, the review.
Hey, of course. Of course. And if we have any more movies like this, Temptation, that I pay $8 to go see when I can sit in my living room that I'm paying Time Warner U-verse for, not Time Warner, but U-verse cable for, I'm not paying $8 when I'm seated on cable TV. All right, guys.
Okay.
I want to thank you.
Yes, sir.
Take it easy.
And this has been the
last word,
Friday. Yep. I'll see you guys next week, everybody. Thanks for listening. Well, Mike Lawson, Thomas Fortenberry, George Gafferty, and the rest of the crew. Goodbye.
That I made you cry.